Welcome to Oil and Whiskey. As you guys see, out of studio yet again. Usually we do a little guest introduction and then say, welcome to Oil and Whiskey. But you're welcoming us. You're welcoming Oil and Whiskey to Canepa Motorsports.
You're more than welcome.
It's something we've been talking about. We've had this plan for a little while. We've been like little kids on like Christmas morning, excited about coming out and seeing and talking to you in person. You've got a very storied past. From race car driver to restoration to an amazing shop, and I think we're excited to figure out some of the where all that came from.
Absolutely,
behind the curtain.
Yeah, we came through here. What was it? 4 years ago, there was a road tour that came through. Yes. And ever since then,
yeah, because you know, George Poteet was a friend of mine.
Yeah, we came through.
He was showing me what he had. Mustangs with Chevy engines in them, right?
Yeah, we built that.
We built that car.
I knew you did.
But since then, I mean, it's been like the talk of the shop. It's just, this is such an unbelievable place. What you do, the vehicles, you service the vehicles, you build the vehicles, you race. It's just, it's unreal. I mean, it's mind-blowing having, like, for me, running a shop and going out and seeing what you do. I mean, it's inspirational, but then it's also, I find, like, sometimes, you know, when things are, like, so much better, it almost, like, defeats you, where you look at it and you're like, shit, that's a... It's going
to
take a lot of work to get that
good. So many balls in the air, too. You get so many balls in the air because it's so, I mean, with everything. I mean, the curating the collection and your own personal cars, the race team. I mean, the showroom, the sales, an entire staff of restoration of, we're talking a little bit off camera about the wide variety of stuff. So it's not like you can just figure out a path and be like, all right, boom, we're going to continue to keep honing this. It's, you never know what's coming in the door next.
Well, I just limit sleep.
Something's got to give, right?
So take us back a little bit on where this kind of all began. Obviously, you started as a race car driver, but where did before
well,
then?
Not really. So when I was born, my dad was a car dealer. Okay, he was in the new car dealer business.
Where at? What
here in Santa Cruz.
Okay,
he had Ford Lincoln Mercury, and he had BMW, and he had International Trucks, and he had other franchises off and on. So he was in the car business, and he was in the car business kind of by default. He was a World War II pilot in B-17s and B-29s. And when he came home, he needed a job, and his sister, he had eight brothers and sisters, and his sister was married to a gentleman that had a Packard dealership. So he went to work there sweeping floors and built all the way up to where by late 60s, he was the dealer. And so I was born, you know, in the car dealership business. I mean, and literally from the time I was a little kid, Dad used to say four, I loved cars. I mean, and back then you stood up on the front seat of the car, no seat belts, and pointed out all the cars.
Well, both
right?
Parents were smoking with the windows.
Yeah, right? My parents didn't smoke. They just went and drove like hell. So anyway, basically that's where I started. So I was exposed to the cars from birth, and I loved them as soon as I recognized what they were. And that never has ended for me, ever. And when I was 10, I was building model cars. And not like anybody else, 10, I was at my dad's body shop and the guys were helping me bondo them and paint them there with stuff you couldn't buy at the model car shop, right? And changing everything. So that was, it started there.
Just addicted. Hooked.
Yeah, addicted. And also at the same time, whether I was on a bicycle or whatever, we didn't have skateboards when I was a kid, but if I was on a bicycle, I was going to see how fast I could go on the bicycle. And crash a whole bunch trying to see how fast I could go. I just wasn't afraid of much. So I went from that to, you know, my dad finally agreed I could have a go-kart if I earned half the money. And I went out and earned half the money at like 11 or 12 and had a go-kart. And then raced, you know, wanted to race a go-kart, which go-kart racing then was, you know, an empty lot with a bunch of wrecked cars and you drove in between them. You know, it was whatever you had. So it just kind of went parallel through the whole thing. And I went, my dad finally let me go work at his dealerships when I was, I think, 13 or 14, maybe earlier, because I wanted to go every day. And he finally let me after school go there, and I started in the same place. You sweep the floors. And when you sweep them perfect, we'll look at your next thing. And I went from sweeping floors to washing cars to detailing cars to working in the body shop because I loved body and paint work. That way, because you could be creative there. And so I went to the body shop and then mechanical and then... Eventually, out of high school, and while I was in college at a local college, Kent Fuller moved here. And the building right next door to this building, which is my building, that was Fuller Chassis.
Oh, wow.
And so I came up and bummed a job there, you know, it's starting from scratch, learn how to do stuff. And you know, Steve Davis was up here, and Ron Atterbury, and Ronnie, the aluminum guy, forget his name. He did the schools for a long time.
Covell,
Ronnie Covell. Ron Covell was behind the building in an old school bus. He was a total hippie. You could smell the marijuana in the morning and be on a park bench out there with a coffee can making it into an owl with a torch. I mean, that's...
Why here? Why was all those guys here?
Well, Fuller hated Los Angeles.
Okay.
Because he was a real introvert. He didn't deal with people, nothing. That's just the way it was. He was just grumbly. You know, he just wanted to do his thing. So this was a place for him to hide, basically. I don't know how he ended up here, but I understand it was what fit him, was to be somewhere remote, somewhere where he still had access to what he needed and didn't have to deal with people. So he came from L.A. to here, and he was here till he retired.
Fuller built the chassis for the Pearson Brothers coupe, right?
I don't think so. He built the top fuel car that Bruce has.
Oh, the
Prudhomme car. Yeah.
Black.
And when I worked for him, that's what he built. He built funny cars and top fuel cars.
Was there racing in the area around here?
Do what?
Was there racing in the area?
Yeah, Fremont. Okay. Drag strip, which was a big deal, and Half Moon Bay drag strip. But he didn't do it because of that. He built the cars. And you know, at any one time you'd come here and Chris Caramassini's was here, or Prudhomme was here, or somebody was here hanging out all the time, because he was it. And he was pretty much a genius. I mean, he really was. I've seen so many guys in my life do things. And he'd take a piece of tubing and weld up the two ends of it with the sand packed in it and bend that thing with no print, no drawing, no nothing. Just do it. And it was perfect every time. I mean, and he worked crazy hours. He would work. He'd leave it. He'd stop working by 2 or 3. There was a bar right up at the end of the street. He'd go there and eat something and drink beer, just beer. And then he'd be back in the shop at 2 a.m. So when you got there at 8, he'd already done 6 hours, you know. And that's who he was, you know. And he was he created things. The four engine cars he built. When I worked there, the Galpin four engine Mustang was the big project at the time, other than top fuel cars for a number of customers. So, but he was quite a guy.
At that age, when you talked about racing go-karts, you talked about working at your dad's dealership and you got in the body shop. You talked about the go-kart going fast. Then you talked about you loved being in the body shop for the creativity and making the stuff looks. At that age, did you care more about speed or looks?
Both. I wouldn't compromise one or the other.
Okay.
If I did a car, it had to look perfect. It better go like hell at the same time. And you know, that's never changed.
Right.
I'm the same exactly way today. I will sit there and have something done perfect and then go out and drive it as fast as it goes. I don't care after it's done perfect. If it gets a nick, if I break something,
it
doesn't matter. When it rolls out perfect, it's going to look perfect. Okay. So that's...
It's a good way. Yeah.
That's a flaw. And I'm okay with it.
Which one wins out if you've got something that's going to be sacrifice performance for looks or sacrifice looks for performance?
Neither.
You just
there's always
out.
A way.
There's always a way.
Yeah.
Never sacrifice.
Yeah. Yeah.
No.
And it's wild. Having talked with Bruce Meyer yesterday and you now, the talent that is around here that everybody grew up with, it's insane. Like, you know, we're from the Midwest, so... And I grew up almost the exact same story as you. Dad was in the body shop business,
right.
Did the same things, played with go-karts, you know, went to work in the shop, swept the floors. The difference, I think, was that, like, we didn't have, like, Craig Knaff or, you know...
Covell. Yeah.
Covell. Yeah. We had Rick. Rick right. was an old guy that drank beer, you know, and drove a conversion van and did body work, right?
Him
and Ronnie Hopkins.
Yeah. We just didn't have that. We didn't have that talent in the Midwest, but that's so much to feed off of. It seemed like from that.
Well, California was such a melting pot for guys modifying everything. I mean, no, you know, California is where it's not stock anymore, right? That's hot rod era, everything. Right. So,
well, as you're working through the dealership with your dad and stuff, as you start, you know, getting a little older in high school, you have to start having those conversations about, you know, what's next, if it's school or what you're gonna. Like want to do. So where does that transition? What did you want to do when you started realizing you got to start like?
What were you going to be when you grew up?
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to be in the car business. I loved it, and I wanted to race. So I did both, and for as long as I could, I did both. There was a point where I had to make a decision to do one or the other full time. But up till then, up till like 82, I was doing both. I'd fly off and drive somebody's race car or our own if it was us. I'd do the races, and then Monday morning I'm at work. And back then you could do that, because back then I could leave on Thursday night and go, you know, land somewhere and qualify a car. And, you know, I drove for Momo a lot back then, and I'd show up, I'd do the practice in the car, I'd get the car qualified, and then we'd do the race and then fly home as fast as I could, because I had to be at work at Monday. You can't do that today, because now it's like every sport, it's a full-time job. You know, it's training all week, and it's this and it's that, and it's selling the wares of your sponsor and all that kind of stuff. So it's changed, but back then you could do that, and that's what I did. And you know, and I did that while I worked for my dad, because I worked my way up at my dad's to where I ran the used car department, and then eventually ran all the sales, and then eventually ran the dealerships. And and all through this, I thought I would remain in the dealership business, but my dad didn't want to. He was trying to slow down, and I was trying to speed up. So you know how that goes. It just gets really difficult. And you know, I said, I want to buy this Toyota dealership, I want to buy this Mercedes dealership, I want a Porsche dealership. And my dad goes, I don't want any of those dealerships. So I had to make a decision. I had to make two decisions in 1982. I had just driven the March GTP car with Bobby Rahal at Daytona, the first prototype car. It's on the wall, that red car. And we were basically equally fast in the car. And then I got asked if I wanted to drive an Indy car and test and all these things. And I said, sure. But then it got down to, okay, by the way, you're going to sign a contract. You're going to work for this person. You're going to sell his stuff. And you're not going to do anything else. This is what you're going to do.
It's getting real.
Getting real. It got real. Very real. And that was a hard decision, because I wanted to drive everything, including Indy cars. But I said, I just started a business. I left my dad's business in 81 and started my own place. And all it was a little tiny office and a body shop and a bunch of used cars out front, you know. So it was like, okay, which is it? And I made a decision then, which was, I went through real hard time thinking I made the right decision, but I made a decision then to have my car business as my work and my racing as fun, and not have racing become a job. So that's the direction I took, and here we are today. I still get to race, and I get to do cars at the same time.
It's wild. When the dealerships, before you moved and did your own thing, at your dad's stuff, when you moved up to that point, were you all doing any type of custom work there?
I modified everything. Everything. I never left anything alone. Drove my dad nuts to get a new car in. I remember when I ordered a 427 Comet in 65. I was only 15. I ordered this Comet, and there was a thing, you could divert this thing to Holman Moody, and they put a 427 in it and all the rest of the stuff. And I didn't tell my dad this, so it shows up on the Hadley Transporter back then. And there's a Lincoln on the Hadley Transporter, and that Comet was more money than that Lincoln on the window sticker. And my dad goes, what the heck? And it didn't have a vinyl roof, and it didn't have white wall tires, and it didn't even have big hubcaps. It had the little hubcaps.
Everything under the
hood. Dad, this is the coolest car in the place.
That's half the size of that Lincoln,
so,
too.
And then I didn't. Then I didn't leave it alone. It goes in the shop, and we're changing the gear ratio, and we're doing this, and we're doing this. And no, I was always, you know, nothing was ever good enough for me the way, you know, appearance-wise or performance-wise, I was always tweaking it. And it didn't always work, as you guys probably know really well.
Yeah.
You know, plenty of times it wasn't
yeah,
what
most
you
of the time
thought
it
was going to
yeah.
be. But yeah, that's how it went.
So you're out on your own. You got your shop. Like you said, small little business. You got used car stuff. You got a body shop. You've made the decision, hard decision, to not go race IndyCar. You're assuming paying into your future. Like, well, the racing thing, but I've got to worry about, you know, the next 40 years.
Yeah.
So you're paying in and you're doing the racing as a hobby. What's the transition on the business side of things, where, you know, get into selling these cars, but now we're going to take on a little bit more work, and we're going to take a little bit more work. Then you get the word of mouth thing. I mean, I'm really interested in how that progression comes to the trust of no problem, build this.
And it wasn't a fixed path. It wasn't like I said, I'm going to do this, then I'm going to do this, then I'm going to do this.
They're usually curvy.
Yeah. And crash and burn a few times. But it wasn't, you know, it was like in 82, I thought, well, I'm not going to race full time anymore. But I'm still going to race, and I'm going to start this business, which started out, you know, with just a thing. But almost immediately, I had a building just for doing different things. And so I started doing that. At the same time, I got a new car dealership. I ended up with a Porsche Audi BMW dealership in Monterey, and then I had a Maserati Lamborghini dealership and a Mitsubishi dealership. And so I had new car dealerships, but I got tired of that business. And they weren't easy then. They're easier today than they were then, but they weren't easy. And I just got bored with it, you know, because the manufacturers kind of tell you how you got to do everything, right? They got a pretty much, here's the standard for this dealership and this one. And I'm not the kind of guy that takes orders very well. So I decided to get rid of the dealerships and just focus on what I was doing, which was specialty stuff. Now, by then, I had started doing a lot of different projects, including I was involved with Kenworth with the first aerodynamic truck. And oh. And I those drawings are still here for the first T.
That was a game changer.
The T600. Mm. And I went to Kenworth with drawings of what I thought it should look like, and they kind of blew me out of there because their new general manager they just placed up in Washington at Kenworth Corporate had been a senior engineer at Denton, Texas at the Peterbilt plant, right? And so the Peterbilt guys are completely different than Kenworth guys. It's owned by the same company, but completely different guys. So here's this guy that's like the fattest, widest, longest hood with the biggest grill, with the biggest lights and the biggest pipes. And I come up there with this thing that he called it a marshmallow. That's what he called it. Looks like a marshmallow.
Did you have an existing relationship?
You went from a cinder block to a marshmallow.
No.
With Kenworth? You just showed up and be like, hey,
I think a truck should look like this.
I think that you should change your business model and make it, because I think it looks better.
I did that because I knew I'd get in a college textbook someday, which I did. Yeah. Which is funny. A guy brought me a text. You're in a college textbook.
You just cold call and say, I'd like to set up a meeting because I'm going to tell
all
your designers.
Well, I was a truck fan. The one thing always from my dad's business, I love big trucks. And I really love big trucks. And so it was just a natural for me to say, it should look different than this, you know? And that's where it started. And then it progressed from really the early 83, 84, 85, somewhere in there, all the way through the late 90s, I did a lot of Kenworth design work. A whole bunch of their trucks, we prototyped them in my shop in Santa Cruz at my old buildings. And they send down a chassis with a cab, and then we'd build a truck. And I did the first electric mirrors with the big struts, and I did the daylight door, and I did the cab and the sleeper as one unit with no walls inside to get more room. And then I built the 76-inch sleeper with a sofa. And it was just, to me, it was make it like a car.
How were you handling that back in that area? Is this like 90s, early 90s?
Yeah, this was 80s.
80s?
Yeah.
So what does that process look like? I mean, is that all CAD driven? Or is it just like...
CAD was a car to me back then.
Yeah, is it paper templates and tape measures?
Yeah, it was drawings on paper, and it was just go out and build it. We did everything at full scale, right off a drawing. Everything. Then they had to reverse engineer it.
Wow.
Kenworth would reverse engineer what I did.
So that's a good gig to be in.
Yeah, that is. When you're doing something like that, are you pulling from some of these resources? Like, do you knock on Ron Covell's van door and tell him, I need some, Ron,
no,
I got to shape this.
I had guys that came
panels.
And did, yeah, Ron and I have known each other forever because Ron did a number of different projects with me. Chip did a project with me on a European truck, a DAF. And I called him in. I said, you want to work on this thing with me? So Chip and I did a DAF, which was Kenworth bought DAF. In Europe, and that became their brand, and we redesigned that truck. But it was just bringing in guys. As you know, I mean, I'd get it to where this is what I wanted to look like, and I pretty much have always had a pretty good sense of what I wanted something to look like. You know, it was just that was somewhere in my gene pool. You know, wasn't anything I learned. You know, there's plenty of things I had to learn the hard way, and that was easy for me. So, you know, the Kenworth thing, just all the development of all those trucks was just. To me, a natural course in thing, you know? Like, I'd sit in and say, you know, the dash needs to do this. This flat dash and trying to reach, that's ridiculous. And I can't see out of here. Just, it was mostly common sense stuff, you know, most of it.
I definitely see what you mean, how you're talking about it. It's curvy. It was not I'm going to do Kenworth, and then that next thing happens, the next thing happens. It's progressing.
The next thing became whatever it became.
Right.
And I did Kenworth, and really the next thing became the Chevrolet Suburban. So General Motors came out with a new Suburban in 90, which wasn't the big square box with straight axles and leaf springs, right? It had independent suspension, it had disc brakes. It was a car, not a truck. And I took one of those immediately, and I got connected with Clay Dean. We became friends. You must know Clay, I'm sure. He was head of design at GM for a long time. And he, at that point, had been handed the truck division to fix it, and that was his fix, that truck in 90. So basically, Clay gave me a truck, and then I changed it. We designed a wheel for it that didn't look like a truck wheel you bought in a tire rack catalog, you know, and it looked like a car wheel. And we put Brembo disc brakes on it, and I went to Whipple, and we did a supercharger for it, and we did real shocks and real sway bars and got it to ride and handle like a car, and brought it down 1 inch, took all the stick-on stuff off, you know, from the side moldings to everything, and just cleaned it up from one end to the other, put really quality carpet, took two more front seats and put them in the middle, moved the back seat back 6 inches. Now you had a comfortable six-passenger car, and I just did it. And then we ended up building more than 1,500 of those in my shops.
Really?
Yeah, 1,500. It was crazy.
For GM, or were you like a
It was everything.
Upfitter,
it was
basically.
GM made it so I get the vehicles, and I was just retailing them. I, you know, Roger Penske wanted one. The first one I did, which went to the LA Auto Show, they put it in the LA Auto Show in their booth as just a thing to look at, and it was such a hit. Mary Hart ended up with the very first one and had it till less than 5 years ago, from 90.
Wow.
Said it was still her favorite vehicle. But
so you're handling all of it. You're handling the building, the marketing, the sales, everything, the whole deal.
The whole thing.
At that point, did this become Canepa Design?
Yeah, Canepa Design started in that era.
Okay.
Which we've dropped it now, basically, because there's so much going on, we just call it Canepa, basically. But yes, that's what it was, because we were doing, I did a project with Mercedes, and I did a project with Ford. Ford sent me the Excursion, and I liked the way it looked, this big old thing, but it drove like an army truck, right?
Yeah.
So I did all the shock development on it and bars and springs and all kinds of things and made that thing to where it really tracked well and didn't bounce down the road and all the stuff. So, you know, I mean, that's, you know, all of that. So just whatever came along, we just did it, you know. And, and the only time I'd say no to a project, it was if they didn't want to do it right, didn't want to listen. And, if I'm going to put my name on it, and it really wasn't about putting my name on it. It was more like, if I'm going to be associated with it, it's got to be this way. That's period. That's it. And if that's not what you want to do, that's fine.
Yeah, if you're coming to me, coming to me for a reason.
Yeah, there's
so
a reason.
Let me do it.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, that's a hurdle.
Yeah.
I struggle with that a lot. We build some wild custom cars, and you've got a lot of opinions, right? You're working for a customer.
Yeah.
Customer, he's got... Usually what happens, they see your work and they're attracted to you for what you do.
Then they
want
to tell you what
to do. Something that's completely different. That's like another builder's.
Then they got to tell you how to build it.
You're like, oh. Or are you firm with that? Do you feel like that was beneficial? I mean, lay down the law and you're like,
for a number of years, you do what you have to do to survive, right?
Of course.
You're working and you don't want to kick a guy out when you need the business, you need the income, you need all those, you need the experience, everything. But at this point in my life, I kick him out. But
yeah,
it's taken very much. And I do it politely, but I just say, I'm not the right person to do what you want to do, because this is the way I would do it. And, that's the way it is. And I just designed the paint scheme on a jet and the guy goes, would you design my paint scheme? Sure. So I just did a paint scheme. He just sent me the pictures of it all done. And I said, okay, now I get to use it, right? So, but, you know, I just, completely different than what they're doing with all the scallops. I call it the motorhome graphics all over these jets, which drive me crazy. So it's, I have to like it, whatever we're doing. I really have to like it because I'm so passionate. But if I like it, then we'll do it. And, you know, I tell guys, if you look around, there's so much variety of stuff here. We restored the first Duesenberg ever built, 001. It belonged to the same family since new. This is 10 years ago. Belonged to the same family since 1921. It was the first car ever built with four-wheel hydraulic brakes new, 21. It had an eight-cylinder motor. I went 85, 89 miles an hour down the freeway in this 1921 car. That family was Dole Pineapple and became Castle and Cook Foods. And Jimmy Castle became a friend, and he had a lot of cars, and we restored him. And then one day he says, I've got my grandfather's, Duesenberg, and I want you to restore it. And it had lived in Hawaii from 1921 to 1968.
It went to Hawaii, the number one.
On a schooner, tied on the deck.
Wow.
And then in 1928, it had to come back because it was in such bad shape, and they upgraded it and rebuilt it and sent it back again. And so when I got it, you can imagine it was pretty bad. Hawaii is a little hard on cars, right?
I'm sure.
And it was there when there was no paved roads, and license plate was number one on it, first car in Hawaii. So anyway, so he brought that to restore, and it's like, you know, when I first talked to him, I said, well, that's not what we do, Jimmy. So then he said, no, I don't want anybody else to do it. So when he brought it here, I said, okay, the guys have to take ownership of it because I'm not doing the work anymore. They don't even want me doing the work anymore. And they're better than I am by a ton. So basically, I brought it in the shop, and everybody fell in love with it, and we restored 1921 Duesenberg, which went on to get Best of Show awards and Best Paint awards and this, that, and the next thing. And
just when you think you've heard like all of the crazy stories and the prominence on a certain individual vehicle, but the first Duesenberg, and then also being the first car, and
that's nuts.
Especially in 21, the connections and the like. How do you end up with the first one? Like, how do you know?
You like doing the restoration stuff? I mean, for a guy, you're obviously a creative guy, and the stuff you've done is kind of like, it's wild. It's all over the place. I feel like for us, for example, I mean, I can't stand restoration because I don't ever want to put something back the way it was. It almost feels like schoolwork. You know, yeah, it's like research, and like, I want to just freestyle.
We did restorations. Well, first of all, there was a period of time, and it's changed, but there was a period of time when restorations were what everybody wanted. They wanted to put it in a trailer and take it and park it on the lawn somewhere for the day and put it back in the trailer and take it home. And it's funny because I describe it as lawn racing. You get up early in the morning and you rush to get the trailer and you rush to load it and you rush to get to the concourse and you rush to get it on the grass. And then you sit all day long and then you reverse rush everything to get home again.
Nothing fun about that.
This is lawn racing.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
And I can't stand it. I mean, I don't have the attention span to stand there all day. I've done it. I've done it for customers. I've done it for myself. But for a long time, that was a big part of the industry was if you were doing what we were doing, you restored cars. And we still restore cars, but I restore cars that are fun cars. If it's not fun, I'm not really interested in restoring it. And like, you know, and everything leaves here not exactly the way it was. You know, I tell guys, we've done about 8 or 10 Cobras. And a number of the Cobra experts have applauded the Cobras we've restored. Not one of those Cobras is stock. You know, first of all, they're too hot inside when you sit in them. So when we put the body back on one, we seal everything up because there's a bunch of gaps all over the place. The footwell boxes, I don't know if you ever looked at one. The footwell box is attached to the frame and the body goes over and then there's gaps everywhere. And it's like a forced air heater. We seal everything up. And then the entire interior of that cabin before we put carpet or anything is full heat insulated, every square inch. And then on those footwell boxes, we basically insulate the front and then do a titanium heat shielding on all of it that you almost can't see. And under the floors, hot coat the exhaust inside and out. And then in the vents up in the cowling that come into the car, that thing, the way the screens are in the front, you can't get air in a car. It won't go in there. You got to go 100 miles an hour because the screen is so restrictive. Inside that hose, we got this air fan that we use in the race cars that blows a hurricane over your feet, right? So we add that to it, and then I send the motors to Jack Roush, and he lowers the compression and does this and does that. So we just got a motor back. We just delivered a Cobra last week to a guy, and it's 487 horsepower, you know, on 91 octane, and huge torque number. Well, that's what you want, right? And so when we're done, we take the original shock completely, but rebuild it with modern technology. So it handles, it turns, it does everything really. I want it to look like it's stock, but I want it to drive completely different. And what's changed is 15 years ago, you know, you were looked down on by the purists if you didn't do these things exactly the way they were. Well, today, and you know it in your industry, that's completely changed because guys want to drive their cars. They want to have them personalized. They want them to be really functional and fun. Because if you get in a 63 Corvette like the one you guys built that's in my showroom, if you get in that car as a 63 Corvette, it drives like shit.
It's horrible.
Right? Yeah. It's terrible.
We're always blown away.
And when I look underneath at how they did that with that spring and all that, what the hell were they thinking, right? This must have been an apprentice engineer, you know? Here's your first project because we don't care. But basically, you know, I want a car that handles, stops, turns, especially after you drive newer stuff. Then you're like spoiled. You know, I put electric air conditioning in 300 SLs, you know. The purists would never allow that, you know. And there's the 300 SL I'll show you in the shop, an Outlaw I'm building right now. Here's a very valuable 300 SL. It holds the record at Bonneville. It went 193 miles an hour 10 years ago. And then I bought that car, and I'm making that a full hot rod street car. So
that's wild.
And you know, and everybody else said, well, how can you do that? Well, why not do that?
At least somebody will get some enjoyment out of it.
Yeah, because you know, if it's not fun to drive, I'm not going to drive it. So,
well, what do you think that I was going to ask this? I mean, obviously, it's because of the customer and what they're wanting, but it's really only been a shift in the 15 years or so that's done that. And the demographic hasn't flopped completely over, but it has changed. You've got newer guys coming in, and we talk about it on the body of reference. Like some of these guys are younger, they don't know how bad that car was beforehand.
What's changed more than anything is we've gone from what I call the lawn, the concourse demographic. Then all of a sudden, guys, we're going to have a tour. We're going to have the California Mille and drive 1,000 miles in 4 days. We're going to do the Colorado Grand. We're going to have the Ram's Horn, which is all Porsches. We're going to have the Sun Copper State, which is that one. There's all these events, and not just in the United States, all over the world. And all of a sudden, your perfect car is going to get on the road, and it's going to get chips and marks and scratches and some wear in the seats. Before, that was absolutely taboo. You didn't do that. You just didn't do that. You know, shit, they rolled them on the lawn at Pebble Beach with the tires covered, right? Now, Pebble Beach has a 60-80-mile tour, right? And that's a benefit to go on the tour, and that's the way it should be. Should be that the car has fluids in it. They were showing cars at Pebble Beach with almost no fluids because they didn't want any seepages. Differentials were empty and gearboxes were empty. They're not driving them anywhere. They're starting it, right?
Riddler.
Chrome brake rotors.
Yeah, Riddler. Yeah. They got
same
one
exact.
Like
they want to fire the motor so you don't glue the headers.
Or yeah. So the events and the change
that changed
of using the cars, that it forced these guys to start using them. Then, like you said, it became accepted.
Well, then they found out it was fun to drive the car,
exactly,
but not their stock one. So they came in, well, I want better brakes on my 356. I want a little more power. I want this better. I want that better. So, you know, it played right into guys like us because I love modifying everything.
Right.
I'll modify every car, including a lot of new ones, you know. I mean, that's just what I do. So if I can make it better visually and drive from a drivability standpoint, then why not? So everything that I own in my streetcar world, from my 72 911, has 300 horsepower, not 200, you know. And it's got different trailing arms and different brakes and different this and different that. My 356 Porsche, which I'll show you guys, 1,800 pounds with 215 horsepower. They had 70 when they were new. And it's a 5-speed, and it's got disc brakes from a 908, and it's got trailing arm suspension in the back from a 911. I mean, it looks like a 356, kind of doesn't, but, you know, other than it's a little fatter and lower, it's like, it's a 356. Yeah, it's a 356 that goes like hell, you know?
Right.
And it's fun to drive it. It handles, it stops, it turns, and everybody wants everything that way now, whether it's a 356 Porsche or Mercedes-Benz or whatever, they want the car to be better. And because for the first time, everybody's driving these cars a lot. You know, they're driving them all the time. And, you know, in 2 weeks, Bruce and I do the California Mille. We'll do over 1,000 miles. And it's funny because when we do it in my 356, and he's my navigator, but we just go like hell. It's ridiculous. I said, we should slow down and look it around us, but we're not.
We've got to get there.
I said, the last California Mille, they said, you passed everybody three times in one day. It's because we'd pass everybody and they go over here. And pass them all, go over here now, and catch them again, you know. So,
yeah.
But that's changed. People are all driving their cars. Whether it goes to a Cars and Coffee or whether they're driving a long tour or a weekend, 150, 200 miles. You know, I get emails daily of, you know, Road and Track. We're doing the Smoky Mountains tour. We're doing this tour. Everybody's into it now. Everybody, Hagerty. And it goes on and on and on and on. So if you don't have a car that's fun to use, what are you going to do?
Right,
you're gonna sit home?
But changes the game. I mean,
best of ways.
What are you gonna do at these? I mean, I'd imagine you, as we walked through here before, so you walked up to the front of that car and you ripped a piece of tape off because you just had it out at the track.
Yeah.
I'm looking at these, I'm thinking like, okay, this is a museum.
Yeah.
But for like, we had a car collection and it sits there, and you don't do a damn thing with it because it's completely useless.
Yeah.
If you can't drive them, I mean, what is the point?
Yeah.
So I'd imagine almost every one of these cars here, I mean, aside
they're
from
all
some
functional.
Of them that are obviously you're not jumping in that slingshot and making quarter mile passes.
No, but it was completely restored to run. So, and like in that case, I bought that car. It was hard to buy that car because the guys that owned it didn't want to sell it. And then Prudhomme's a really good friend. So I said, Don, I tried to buy it. I can't buy it. So you try to buy it. They told Don no. Then they came back to Don and said, well, we'll do this partnership deal with you. And Don called me up and he says, okay, let's do it anyway. So we started this partnership deal. When Don restored that car, He brought Don Long back into the mix to do the chassis because he built the chassis. Ed Pink did the motor. And here's a perfect story. That motor was 2,000 horsepower in 68. Wow. Ed didn't like that. It's now 3,000 horsepower. Like, okay.
What are you going to do with
it? So, but that car is totally functional. When it was all done, we had a Cars and Coffee here, and Perdomo was up spending the weekend with me, and we took it downstairs and fired it up outside and shocked everybody, you know, because a lot of people never heard one of those things, you know. So all these cars are 100% functional, every one. Some of them are pickled because we're not using them, but we can roll one out, put the fluids in it, check everything, go. I don't restore a car in probably 60, 70% of these cars in here were restored in our shops over the last 25, 30 years. I'm not going to restore them unless they're 100%. It's not an art object for me. You don't see any of them hanging on the wall, you know.
You ever have to force some of your customers to drive them and use them instead of keeping them as garage queens?
That's the toughest thing, is that they say they're going to drive them and they don't have time. And what I tell all my customers is, I said, look, what we know is that cars need to be operated to stay in good shape. If you park it, it deteriorates. I don't care if you put it in the best controlled environment in the world, it deteriorates. There's moisture and brake fluid and there's this and that. I said, they've got to go outside every 30, 45 days. Somebody needs to drive. They don't need to go fast, but they need to bring everything to operating temperature.
They're not inanimate objects.
No.
They're just like living, breathing creatures.
No, well,
if you
it seals and gas, everything will deteriorate.
Months, you wouldn't be able to get out of bed.
No, exactly.
Yeah, you got to get up.
Maybe 30 days at my age. But really, that's true. I mean, these cars, and the ones that get used, like yesterday I had a customer's car come here, you know, very, very valuable Ferrari, and the guy that takes care of the cars, which is Ken Miles' son, Peter, and we're good friends, he drove that thing up here because he said, you know, he drives them, which is exactly what they need. He drove it from Carmel to here, you know, and back. So that car won't have problems if you do that. You park that in the garage for 6 months, it leaks, it does this, it does everything, so.
Over, nice transition into, you know, talking about the museum, talking about a lot of the cars that you've had. When did you start acquiring cars along the way? When you were at your dad's dealership or after? I mean,
no, I didn't have any money when I worked for my dad. He never paid me much. He paid me less than everybody else. Every time I got a promotion, when I got through sweeping floors and I got to wash cars, I said, do I get a raise? He said, when you learn how to wash cars really good, you get a raise. And then when I learned how to wash cars, do I get a raise now? Yeah, when you learn how to detail them really good, you get a raise. So.
Did your brother make more? Because now I'm thinking, maybe somebody's pronouncing the name wrong in the first place.
A little fancy.
My brother, to his credit, never worked. But anyway, no, I didn't have the money to collect cars then. I wanted to, but I just didn't have it. And I really, you know, it's funny. I got hooked on Porsches when my dad was a new car dealer for domestic cars. He took a car in trade in 69, a Porsche 911, and I snuck it out and drove it. He took it in on a Lincoln. And I took that night, I got in and drove it, and I said, oh my God, this is a whole different world. And then I drove it every night, and I think when they finally sold it, it had 4,000 more miles on it. And the good thing was, my dad's used car manager was alcoholic, so he couldn't figure it out. Right? So, but anyway, that hooked me on Porsches, and then I worked enough money to buy one that was in bad shape, and then I restored it, and then another one, and then I finally got to where I bought a one-year-old one, and that was probably when I was 26 or 7 or something, you know, and really started collecting cars not till the 80s. So, but now the 79 Porsche 935 that's here, I've owned that car since new. I had a partner in it and I had a big sponsor, but that 79 935 was built at the factory and I've owned it since new. It's the only one owner 935 in the world. That 934 and a half, the 11 car, which was the first sports car I ever raced, I've had that since 78. Oh, wow. So, you know, I've got cars that, but they weren't worth anything then either, you know. I mean, what money you would have gotten for one would have been wasted in an hour, you know. So you know, and over the years, I mean, I own the last Cobra ever built. That's in my collection. So I've just...
Bruce owned the first.
It was the first one, yeah. And I've got the best one. I got the last one. It's just like the Pearson Coupe and the Dragster. It's the same thing, you know. But anyway... So I always wanted cars, and I always liked the cars more than money. You know, my passion was the cars, still is, obviously. I said, there's days I don't have enough money, but I got plenty of cars. But, you know, that's my passion. So as I could add and add and add to this, I just kept adding to
you
it.
Had, we talked about this with Bruce Meyer as well on the list. Did you have a list running in your head that you keep adding to, and then you knew you'd get, or did things come about along the way, or is it?
Well, it's I think it was Bruce's list, and then just one-upping it.
Yeah, that's part of that. That's true. But part of it was it's a learning process, right? So what I thought I wanted in the beginning, those things change over time, right? I mean, it just keeps changing, and it still changes. I mean, even to this day, Bruce and I compare notes on what we want next, right? And you know, we'll do that till we're gone. But you know, it's a big learning curve because, like anything you do, it's a skill set. So if you have good taste in cars and all that stuff, you still do the research and learn why you should have this one versus this one or this one versus that one. And for me, it's appearance, it's performance, it's how it was built, it's the history of it, if it's a race car, it's especially the history of it. It's kind of all those elements, and that's with anything. Like, you know, with what you guys build, it's the same thing. You build one for a guy, and it's okay, and you build this one, and this one's really cool because you got to do it the way you wanted, you know. And that isn't by accident. That's a zillion years of experience doing it. And I said, you know, a lot of us have done a lot of things more wrong than we have right. That's how we got here, right? So...
What's the part of the process? Speaking of that, and I guess all of my mind's going all over the place, looking around and going down that train of thought. Has there been a car that's been on your list that you wanted, and then you did one for a customer, and after driving it, you're like, I'm going to take that one off the list. I don't need to get that car anymore.
Oh, yeah, for sure. More than one. Yeah, there's cars that you know, you were attracted to how it looked and maybe how it sounded or whatever, and then you drove and you say, yeah.
I got it out of my system. How's that working?
Yeah. So
I mean, that's a nice thing. About,
there's always something like that.
It's a nice thing about being in the business. It goes both ways. There's certain ones that you get out of your system that you build for your customer, and you're like, eh, don't need it. And then there's other ones that you're really never even into, and you
got to add it
build
to the
it,
list.
And then you're like, yeah, I kind of need one of those. Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's exactly right. It does go both ways. Yeah. Exactly.
But then you look, sometimes on that car, you're blown away, you're surprised. But then what you're attracted to is everything that you just did to it, and you start going back in your head, and you're like, man, to do it, like, we'd have to do that again, and if we're going to do it, we're going to probably do it a little bit better. So it's not like just a car you go out and buy. It's the build. It's the creation. It's like,
oh,
you
it's
said,
all of it. Yeah.
Upping everything there, you know, horsepower-wise.
Well, and if you're really passionate, you're never satisfied with it, ever. So it's always the next one, the next one, the next one that never ends. But that's okay, you know?
Do you... Do you enjoy the hunt and the archaeological dig and the history part of things as much as enjoying the vehicle as well? Or is that just
yes.
like part of it?
Oh, no. I mean, it's all part of it. It's especially if you have to work for your money, you know, that's part of it. I mean, you got to earn enough money to get there, and then it's always a little bit out of reach, and you keep going until you finally get there. And then I tell the story, that 917 right there, that number two car. So... I wanted a 917 forever because to me that's the most beautiful racing car ever built of any manufacturer and one of the most successful of any manufacturer. So I wanted one. Well, the very first one that was available to me was about $1 million and I couldn't afford it. It was out of reach and I tried and then it ended up, it's funny because I tried and I got an offer on it and number and then next thing I know it was going to an auction and then Jerry Seinfeld bought it. He has it. He has basically a duplicate of that car. It was a Steve McQueen car, but he has one. And it ended up being like $1.4 million somewhere in there. And I said, well, okay, can't do that. And then the next one came up. I finally, you know, worked up, got a little closer. And the next one came up and it was like, you know, $1.6 million. And I, you know, it was just, in fact, I think I offered $1.6 million and it was more, didn't get that one. And then finally you just get to a point and say, I don't give a damn. I'm just going to say yes to the right one.
It's hard to out-earn the appreciation of the cars. Like when you keep trying. Like,
it is. It's really hard. And
bite it off and buy it now. Yeah. It's going to go up.
And that's what I did on that one. I mean, the day I said yes on that car, and I ended up with the best of all the cars. That car was the first 917 to win a 24-hour race. It won 7 other races. It's a Gulf car, which is the most recognized livery. And it belonged to the family that started Gulf Oil. They had it.
Oh,
and,
wow. You told Jerry Seinfeld that yours is better than his?
Yeah, I've told him that. Yeah. Hey, I might be the only guy at a major concourse like Pebble Beach that beat Jerry Seinfeld. I said, see, it doesn't help to be a comedian here. We're good friends. I've done a number of cars for him over the years. He's a great customer, but he's a great car guy. He does it for all the right reasons. He drives the cars.
That's cool.
He's really a car guy. He really is. So, you know, there's a lot of pretend guys, as we all know, you know. So he's not one of them.
Where'd the number three car come from?
That's another long story. So I wanted an Earnhardt car. And I went to a couple of people that I knew, and they said, you got to talk to Chocolate. And Chocolate basically ran the team back in the day during that era. And he still works for Richard, overseeing, I think, the winery and the properties and whatever else. He's still with him. So I went to Chocolate, and I knew him but didn't really know him, and spent some time with him. I said, look, I really want a Wrangler Dale Earnhardt car. And he said, well, there aren't any. He said, in 87, he said, we only, I think he told me they built four chassis. And he said, we had other chassis previous and stuff, but he said, we only built four that year. And he says, one of those is destroyed. One's in the Daytona Museum. One is with the guy that was the chief engineer at General Motors in Ocala, Florida. He still has it. That's the spin and win car. And this one was with a guy that sponsored Dale kind of privately and helped Richard, and he had it privately in his collection. And he said, Bruce, he says, our car we built, he said, it's not an original one. He says, the one we have is not original. We don't have any of them. So he says, I don't know how you'll find one. So I just kind of, like all these cars, it's the same process. You don't take no for an answer, and you just keep kind of bothering a few people, you know. And I've done that on a number of these cars. I just kept bothering them, you know, call them in 6 months, call them in 12 months, call them again, call them again.
Little notes in bottles and throw them out in the ocean.
Yeah.
And you never know if somebody's going to call you. Yeah.
That's right. So basically, I kept asking around, and then Chocolate called me one day, and he said, Bruce, he said, this gentleman that had this car, he said, he's going through a divorce, and he's got this other problem because I think his wife reported him to the IRS or something.
He's got a lot of problems.
You know,
big problems. Divorces make some cars change hands.
Yeah. Anyway, and he said, so he said, you know, he says, I think you might be able to buy this car. So that's how I got that car. And then we restored it because the next year it was a Goodwrench car. Remember, it was black and all that. So we peeled all that off and took it back down and restored it to back to exactly as it was when it raced. So
that's cool.
Does finding the next car or stepping up to the next level, does that keep you motivated and keep the excitement going and the passion alive?
Well, the passion has never gone away. It's gotten bigger. My ex-wife, she'll tell you. It got worse instead of better. You know, I'm the only ex-wife that loves me, just doesn't want to be number two to a car. So, but that's never gone away because for me, the creative side of me is always trying to figure out what do we do next, what's cooler. I mean, even like my simple 356, my little 356, that car was done more than 10 years ago. And then we just did a speedster that's back there that I did a whole bunch of things I didn't do to my car, that if I did my car over again, I'd do all those things to it, you know? So that's a constant. And I know you guys are exactly the same because I see what you're building and where you started. I didn't know how far back you were, but I mean, that's what you, every day you look at something and figure out how to do it better or different or whatever it happens to be, you know, or not at all. So, but that's, I can't imagine that ever going away. And you know, I like cars that you can drive, whether it's a race car or a street car. I like cars that you're a part of the driving experience. You don't just get in, push a button, and it does everything. I like cars that you have to know how to modulate the brake pedal without locking up the wheels, and you have to turn it. You know, it's not electric steering. You have to turn it, and you have to shift it. And I like analog kind of cars because you're totally connected with an analog car if it's going to perform well, because you have to be part of what makes it perform well. It may have all these things, but if you can't do part of it, you're not going anywhere.
It's hard to get bored when you're always having to do something.
Yeah, exactly.
And pay attention.
Exactly right.
Involved and on it all the time to make it go.
We asked Bruce Meyer last night this question. He had a pretty good story. So what's the hardest you've ever had to work to acquire a car that you really wanted badly?
Oh.
He's got a good Clark Gable story. He put 20 years in for that car.
To get it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, Bruce has more money than I got, so he only has one story. I got 10 of them.
You put the work in.
It's been the same with a lot of the cars. I mean, that 917 is a perfect example. I mean, I wanted one for a long time, and it was always out of my reach. And then I just, the funny thing is, I don't think I slept a week after I said yes, trying to figure out how I was going to get all this put together, you know, drain every bank account, you know, everything, right? I'm getting this car. So I've done that at least a handful of times. And I do, that's how I am with everything. That's the way I race. I'll just say, the guys will say, what's this like? I'll get in the corner. I'll figure it out when I get there, you know? So I do everything the same way, you know? And Bruce knows.
Believe it or not, Bruce
has ridden with me. He rides with me in everything, but he rides with me in a 935 Porsche at Laguna Seca, which is an incredibly fast car, which is incredibly loose. Serious. I mean, I'm throttle oversteer all the time at very high speeds, and he's totally relaxed and enjoys it.
Wow.
Not many people do that. I took Prudhomme, and we had to peel him out of the car, lay him on the concrete, and he was behind the pit wall for 30 minutes on his back.
It's a little different when you're not going straight.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I told him, I said, you guys, I said, you get it, you smoke a cigarette, and you do a beer commercial, and you sign a bunch of damn autographs, and then you get in the car, and you go 4 seconds or 5 seconds,
yeah,
and you get out, and an hour and a half later, you do it again. All you did was have another cigarette and another beer commercial and a bunch more autographs. I go, that's not racing. We do this for an hour and a half nonstop till we have to have fuel and tires.
Wheel to wheel. Yeah, wheel door to wheel. Door.
Oh, God. When I took him for a ride, it was amazing because we've been friends since the late 70s. He had never been in a real sports car like these. He had never been on a racetrack like Laguna Seca, any kind of real, you know, dedicated racetrack. That was his first ride in the thing. And I had just taken three different ladies for a ride in it, a gal that worked at Porsche Motorsports and another gal that's a really good writer. And is it Elena from the magazines?
Alana,
I took her for a ride in it, and all the girls got out and just loved it, just thought this was the best. And then I put Prudhomme in it, and he was a meltdown. It was hilarious.
Yeah, I can't make it a half lap without.
It's tough being a passenger.
Yeah. Well, I tell everybody, I said, I would never ride with me.
What are you on the hunt for right now?
I can't say. I might. I'll tell you what the problem with that is.
Bruce
and I both learned that lesson the hard way. We have friends that are, they can buy anything they want and everything they want. And if we mention something we want, all of a sudden it's in their garage. So,
gotcha. Understood.
It's got to be at this point. Like, how many unicorns are still out there, though?
Lots of. Well, it depends on you, what you want in a unicorn changes every day.
I suppose.
You know? So.
So yeah, we got such a wide scope of cars. It's
there's so many different genres.
And yeah, you and Bruce both. It's like you're walking around. And you're like you have the coolest of the cool, and just Dan Gurney's car and the SoCal car and Dale Earnhardt's car.
Oh yeah, and I've got the best of the Gurney cars too. He's got the second best.
I love this.
that's four for four.
They're both wild collections. Most collections I feel like are driven by like it's sentimental. It's something that people had as they were a kid, they were younger, something they remembered. But obviously, it's not like your dad had a 917 Porsche that you're like, I gotta have one of those. So that's a difficult way to build a car. Like for me, it's a, you know, I'll grab a 93 Typhoon.
Yeah.
Because it was cool. You know, when I was a kid, that was a badass car. Well, you could get your hands on that.
Right. Yeah.
These things. I mean, it's well, a
but it is the same because what I don't buy a car and I don't buy a car just say I have one. I don't buy a car to say, you know, because somebody else says you got to have one. I strictly buy what I like. Yeah. If I don't like it, I mean, look, there's an Austin Healey Sprite over there that happened to have a bunch of race history, and there's a Fiat 600 over there too, you know, and then there's two 917s, right? So I have to like the cars, and if I don't like them, I get rid of them and get something different. It's not just to amass a bunch of cars, and I really have to like them a lot.
Well, that's what goes to the like you were talking about, from both of the collections that we've seen, so many people they fall into that path. Collecting anything, really, you go down this path, you start going over the quantity over quality.
Yeah.
Right? Because you're collecting things. So in your mind, you start having to add to the collection. And as the collection grows, and as you have more of whatever, I don't care if it's fucking coins or cars or whatever it is, you're going to try to have more of them. But then you start losing the quality because it's just trying to get more of the thing.
Yeah, but there are large collections where every car is a spectacular piece. But it just, you know,
There's a lot more huge collections.
The nice thing about this is there's no set of rules. You can do whatever you want. If you want 50 cars and they're all mixed up different things, have it. If you want 300, have 300. If you want five, have five.
And whatever makes you happy.
Whatever makes you happy. Because if you're not happy doing this, then you miss the whole point of it. I mean, you really miss the whole point. So.
Yeah, so we've been to so many of these car collections where it's like a guy has every single year that Chevrolet ever made, or every color of something ever made, and you're like, not that cool.
But he said it best though, and I've said the same thing. We looked at that and like, man, I mean, like, add something else to the trade. But if it makes him happy at the end of the night to know I'm the only one, that has consecutive serial number, one of every color. And the weird, you know, plum crazy with the white interior and they didn't make
the
it.
Deep glove box.
No, I just tell people I'm confused. I don't know what I want yet.
It falls in line with all of our styles. Like, you can just walk up to something, you just know what's cool by looking at it, and that's what you want. And then we're going to go get a Salt Flats car, and then an Indy car, and a vintage sprint car, and just finding, like, the right cool, unique stuff, not necessarily just stockpiling that certain collection because it's a low production number or a one of one, or got to have the 57 because you have the 55, 6, and 8.
Because somebody else says it was cool. That's the problem. Like you said, y'all mentioned cars, and somebody else be like, well, if Bruce said it was cool, then I need to go get one.
Yeah.
Right? Well, if it doesn't speak to you, no matter how cool that car is, if it doesn't speak to you, you might not think it's cool.
Yeah.
So those cars that speak to different people, I mean, we disagree on this stuff, all the time on stuff. I'm like, that thing's fucking cool.
Yeah.
And I was like, it doesn't really do anything for me. And that's fine. It doesn't mean it doesn't mean somebody's right.
No, exactly. Well, like what you see in here, I've been around racing all my life. I went to Can-Am races. I never drove a Can-Am car, but I went to Can-Am races. I drove sports cars. I went to Pikes Peak and drove. So, I mean, there's all different things in here that relate to me in ways. And I mean, I saw Richard Petty drive, and I saw, I saw those guys drive all those cars, and on and on and on. So I have a connection to all those cars. So that's why this is what I've collected, because I remember seeing that car race or that car race or that car race, and then in between there's a number of them that I got to race. So
it's still the same sentimental, the memories. You just grew up in a cooler environment.
And then
your memories are just better.
Better memories, better cars.
And then in road cars for me, the cars that this is just the museum for race cars, but my road cars are all about cars that I like for all the same reasons. I like them the way they drive. I drive them. I use them. They're not sitting there just to be sitting there. And everybody looks at me as the Porsche guy, right? So, yes, I have. If you told me I could only have one car, if it was one race car, it'd be my 935 that I've had since 79. If it were one street car, it'd be a 959. That'd be it, period. I'd be done. But I like other things. I have a Ford GT, and I've got a Cobra, and I've got a Raptor R pickup that I think is the most fun thing I've ever driven.
You know who doesn't have a Ford GT? Yeah.
Jeremy doesn't have a Ford GT.
So we're like, I think this makes it now 95% of our guests own Ford GTs.
A new one?
The 0506.
Yeah, I have the newer one.
Yeah, and some guys have those too, but I do not. I do not have one, and I really...
It's became quite the thing over the last couple of years.
It comes up every time. Yeah.
Everybody's got them now.
Yeah.
You don't have one.
Yeah. I just like them. I like the new one now. I mean, I think it's so cool looking.
How do you like driving the 0506?
I like them both. They're both different, but I like them both. Yeah.
What's the scariest car that you own?
The scariest? Scariest in what way, though?
Well, the one you're in it, the one that you're the most scared of. For whatever reason that is.
Well, I have a fault in that I'm not afraid of much.
Okay.
It's bit me a few times. I think probably the scariest thing to drive are these 917s, because like I told you, that's 1,800 pounds and 1,300 horsepower. And the acceleration rate, it handles and goes through the corners fast. It does everything. And it's funny, about 6 years ago, 7 years ago at Laguna Seca, they had historic cars when they had the IMSA cars, and they had the new LMP prototype cars, which is the couple generations after the ground effects cars I drove, the 962s and stuff. And I remember that the fastest one was like a minute 18 something, must have been about 7 or 8 years ago, like a minute 18 something. And I went out and did a low, almost a 120 flat in a car from 1972. I'd have been in the second or third row in that car. So that's, it's crazy. I mean, it's crazy the guys race those things, because you saw there's nothing to it, nothing. There's zero safety in the thing. But the cars worked so well. They did everything so well. Acceleration, stopping, turning, handling. They really are magnificent cars to drive. And they'd have to be to go that fast when something 40 years later, 30 years later is that barely faster, right?
I should have rephrased that. It should be the car that you respect the most. Because, well, like you said, you're not a guy that's
I respect those the most.
Right.
I think it's touching that story we talked about before the podcast.
It's amazing. When you're talking about the aluminum roll cages and the lady from Porsche and which...
Yeah.
That was awesome.
Yeah, she was serious.
Basically, was telling,
and she was right. They had plenty of drivers. Everybody wanted to drive a Porsche car.
You're complaining about
there's safety. Zero safety features. There's anti-safety features in it. Yeah, made out of what? 090, 060 aluminum. What was it?
Yeah, it was whatever it was. It's useless
it's
anyway.
Paper, right?
First of all, when you see the, I'll show you the. When you see how they joined the tubes together, that's the biggest laugh in the world anyway. So you get the plastic in a model when you pull the pieces out was stronger than the way those cages were built.
Are you able to run those cars? I mean, I'm guessing you are because of the lap times you're putting down. But is the value what the car is worth? Does that like linger
no.
in the back of your mind when you're
no.
you just
it, if it did, I wouldn't drive it.
Yeah.
You know, you just, I mean, these two cars here, these are, that's an extremely valuable car.
Yeah.
Okay, and. You know, I'll tell you a funny story. Bruce and I, one day, we went and drove off in his Ferrari. You saw his 250 short wheelbase Ferrari, which is a Le Mans class winner. And we went up to the canyons to the rock store. And we were going up there because of tons of motorcycles and people. And so I'm driving the 250 short wheelbase. And we're cruising up through the roads. And Leno was on his way up, all the guys. We're headed up there. And we get in there, and we see a place to park. And I pull into the place to park. And we get out of the car. And these guys are all going, well, what is this? You know, it's a Ferrari, it's a 250 short wheel. Bruce is answering questions, I'm answering questions. And of course, there's never a time that somebody doesn't ask you how much a car's worth, right?
Of course.
It's just every car, every place. What's this car worth?
Bit of $100,000 in that thing.
And so this guy goes to me, he goes, how much is that car worth? And I go, about the same as a really nice house. And the guy looked over at his buddy, he goes, that damn car's worth $500,000.
Like a really, really nice house.
Right? Yep. It's all relative,
it is.
You know?
It's 100% relative. That was the best answer you could have given him. Because he put the value in his head.
Yeah. You know, we obviously he didn't have a house on the coast of Malibu. Right.
Wow. That's a really good answer.
Anyway.
We have to steal that one.
Yeah. Standard question, Tom, because I know we're going to do a little walk around. You're way too knowledgeable and you got way too cool stuff for us not to take advantage of the opportunity to show us around some stuff. So standard questions is stuff we ask just about every guest. We're always interested in different answers. So one is the best piece of advice that you've ever received.
Oh, my dad gave me a whole bunch of them. God. Well, I think, you know, my dad was a very hardworking person, and I've always been a very hardworking person. I mean, he bred that into me, and that's the way it had to be. And it's never changed. And I think the reason for me it's been easy, you know, and I do 12, 14-hour days. I think it's easy because the thing that my dad taught me is he says, find something you love, and that's what you should work at. If you don't like your job or if you don't like what you're doing, life's going to be miserable, work will be hard, and you won't be happy. So,
good advice.
You know, I do what I like.
That's why you put 12, 14-hour days.
Exactly.
Because you enjoy doing it.
That's exactly right.
Next up is your favorite car movie.
Oh. You know, I don't think I can pick one because at different generations, the movies have changed, you know, in terms of the quality of the movies and this and that. I mean, I liked Le Mans with Steve McQueen. I think that's cool, but I'm a Porsche guy too. But I just went and saw that, you know, the latest Enzo movie, which an Italian lady that worked at Ferrari told me it's not accurate. But I said, I don't care. I go to movies for entertainment.
Right.
I'm not a critic. I don't care if it's perfect. If I leave the movie happy, smiling, and know it, and completely distracted from all the other things in my life for
you
that 2 hours.
Entertainment.
You know, that's it. So I like that new movie too, you know, and Bruce and I saw it together and we both thought it was really fun, you know, and it was cool. And I like the people that were in it, everything. So, you know, it's, I just go for entertainment movies, and if they're fun, I watch them. But, you know, Grand Prix was a great movie and Le Mans was a great movie. And of course, with today's technology, Enzo was amazing, and all those guys in Enzo, the actors were just unbelievable. So
I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, it's good.
You need to go watch it.
Yeah.
Next up, first vehicle, your first car, and a story about that car.
My first car was a 1929 Model A Ford.
Wow.
It belonged to a local plumber, old Italian that my dad knew, and Joe Vaggioli owned it. That was his plumbing truck. He took the deck lid off. He had a big wood bed in the back, and all this plumbing stuff was in that car, and it was used every day to go do plumbing jobs. And that was the first car I bought, 1929, and it was completely stock other than the wood bed in the back of it, and it was $400, and that's
where I started. What'd you do to it?
You know, I took it apart and didn't know how to put it back together again.
Got to start somewhere, right? Yeah.
Live and you learn.
Yeah.
Oh, man, that's good. Now we have a newer question that we've been putting in. Your favorite law enforcement interaction story.
Oh, God.
There's got to be some good, because, I mean...
Car guys always have them.
Yeah.
None of these have front license plate provisions, right? You know, the tires are a little stickier than they should be.
Well,
I'm sure they've been on the
street. There's videos of me driving those on the freeway to Santa Cruz and over the hill. And that one, and a 970, actually, the Can-Am Championship car. I drive all the race cars on the road. I mean, and I drive them just to, you know, see if everything shifts right and all that stuff, but it's just a car, you know, it's not a big deal. But law enforcement, I'm lucky. I'm a member of a group that kind of helps when you know that they kind of, you know, they politely tell you not to do it, but you know sometimes
so
they
you're
let you
you're not work. A pro defund the police guy. You're more of a fund the police.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, totally.
It's a good way
but
of putting it.
I was testing a 959 sometime back, and we had done. We've done that engine in three different generations of upgrades, and you know, it's one thing to put them on a four-wheel chassis dyno. We have those four-wheel dynos. One thing to put it on that. It's another thing to have the engine on a dyno, but it's completely different to put it on the road and do full throttle runs and gather all the data. Right. So, no passenger seat in the car. Computer stuff, wires taped on it, and I had to go to a board meeting in. Monterey to the track to Laguna, and there's a road outside of Castroville. It's a shortcut across to one. It just you get on it just past Moss Landing, and then you get back on one again. And that road has a long straightaway and a dog leg and a dog leg, and then a long straightaway, and then you get to one again. And you can go fast there. I've gone 227 down that road, two lane road, in a Bugatti EB110 Super Sport with a passenger watching the speedo, you know, and she was smiling. So I'm in this 959 and I turn the corner and I'm going to do full throttle in every gear, full throttle runs. And I go through the two dog legs, and a 959 works so good, that all wheel drive, that you can go through those dog legs at 140 mile an hour flat, just flat. And it's a flat, it's a two-lane road with a slight crown and dirt on it all the time because the tractors go back and forth. Artichoke fields on both sides, right? So I'm just trucking down that thing, and I get going down the other end towards the overpass, and I see a car parked up on the overpass facing me. I can't tell what it is, but nobody parks up there but a California High Patrolman or a sheriff or something. So basically, I slowed that thing down. I was up to 170 when I saw him. And I got in the brakes and started bringing it down as fast as I could. And I tell guys, it's not easy to bring a car from a buck 70 down to 50 or 60. That's a lot of effort. So I had that thing
brakes.
Just, whoop, huh?
Some glowing brakes.
Glowing brakes. So anyway, I got down there, and as I got close, I just pulled over because, you know, no reason not to. So he came off the overpass, and he did a U-turn right behind me, and he came up on the passenger side, and he goes, first thing he does, what is all this? I go, well, it's test equipment, because it was stuff on the dash, too, and the air fuel ratio was right in front of me. I was watching that the most. I didn't want to lean that thing out. So, and it shouldn't with the computer, the MoTeC, but, you know, you don't want to take a chance. So I had a couple things going on, and so he says, I need, you know, your driver's license. I handed my driver's license and my CHP card and, you know, that registration and stuff. And he went back to his car, and he was gone. Well, 10 minutes seems like 30 when you're right. stopped, right? So he was gone a good 10 minutes, and he came back to the car, and he didn't know me. And most of the high patrolmen do know me. I think he was probably new in the area. And he came back, and he said, you need to speak to the commander. And he hands me his cell phone. And I just looked at it for a second, like, and he says, no, you need to speak to him. So I picked up the cell phone, and I won't tell you what he said.
Did it start with Bruce?
There was an F word in there. You know, what the, you know, and he had been with me on the racetrack in the 935. His father was a high patrolman here in Santa Cruz when I was a kid. So, I mean, I have some reputation for driving too fast. And so he just kind of, you know, just basically explained to me that I'm never to do that again in that county. And then the high patrolman handed me all my stuff back, and he goes, you know how fast you were going? Because he'd asked me, and I said, I don't know.
So he clocked you.
He said, come with me. I walked back, and it was on the radar thing, and it was like 168 miles an hour he had on the radar thing.
Should let him
know
that.
Never seen that before, have you?
that helps. I needed that. That helps me calibrate the speed over. Like,
yeah, that was close.
Oh, that was the other funny part. He told me that it hadn't been calibrated in a year, and he said, want to know if I thought that was accurate. And I said, I have no clue.
I thought I was doing 60 or 70.
There's a one in front of it.
Yeah.
One last question, and I'm super interested. You've driven a lot of stuff, from racing to just regular daily drivers to customers' cars to cars that you've just restored, all kinds of different stuff, in all different types of manners and all different reasons and all different passengers. A lot of times when you're in a car alone, you're thinking, your stuff's going through your head. I want to know, when you think back about the most emotional or the greatest time, whatever it is that you've had behind the wheel. I don't want to know about the story of why you were having such a great time. I just want to know the car. I want to know the car you were driving that you look back and you're like, that, I'm not talking about the best driving or the fastest or any of that stuff. There was a time that's the most emotional, connected, or happiest, or whatever it is that you've been behind the wheel of a car.
You couldn't say it once. There's not once. I mean, the first time, honestly, first time when I drove a car, period, you know. And the first car I drove actually wasn't a car, it was a truck, it was a dump truck. My dad had all this redevelopment land, and he was an international truck dealer. And he said, if you can figure out how to drive that, you can drive. And it had four and a four in it, and I was rolling in no time. I was 12, probably. So that was a big deal just to move, right?
Right.
The second time was when I got my Model A, just to have a car, you know. The third time was driving the Porsche for the first time, you know, when I snuck it out and drove it. That was a whole different experience, because all I'd ever been in was American cars, which, you know, they went in a straight line pretty good. They did nothing else, right? And they made good sounds, but so that was that. And then I always tell guys, you know, because there's two sides for me. It's the racing and the road cars, right? The most fun, the most exciting thing I ever drove the first time in a race car was a sprint car. Because I climbed in it, and I had a really good mentor. He was famous at the time, and he said, this is what you can do, this is what you can do, this is what you do. I'll tell you what to do, and I'm going to watch you from down in the corner and tell you, you know, and I'm going to drop my arms when you lift. And so I had somebody to walk me through a first lap in qualifying almost flat. And, you know, it was like, I've never forgot that. And it taught me more than anything, because I was never afraid then again to see how far can you go with the things, because, you know, it was unbelievable.
Wow.
And that whole experience in those cars, the power to weight ratio and the way you're driving with the throttle. I used to tell guys, I learned that the steering wheels were just for hanging on to when you flip over. But basically, there's nothing like that car. You know, no modern race car that I've been, nothing like a sprint car.
It was 700-800 horsepower.
Yeah, they were about 800 when I drove them, and 1,200 pounds. So I just got in one last November.
Really?
Mm-hmm. A World Outlaws car.
Were the suspensions as free when you were driving as they are now? Like,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
Three-wheeling.
Yeah,
yeah.
Okay.
It did all that. The tires weren't as good as now. The car I just got in, the tires, the two biggest things that have changed dramatically in the cars, the tires is number one, and then what they've done with the wings and stuff is number two, because they got a lot of downforce now on them. But the tires is the biggest deal. I just climbed in one, and I hadn't been in one since 81.
I bet that brought back some memories.
It was cool, you know. And it was cool because it felt like this feels right, you know, like
it's like home.
I wouldn't mind doing it again, except I also remember you can get hurt doing this deal.
Roll them over. I'd like to see how one of those compares to a 2002 Camaro.
Yeah.
Oh, you think?
I mean, it can drift.
The ultimate drift.
Yeah,
machine.
That thing would drift.
That was same deal. That was you're steering entirely with your right foot.
Yeah.
Oh. Steering wheel is just loosely going round and round in your hands.
Well, and it's amazing how much car control that teaches you. It's hard to explain to people. You know, I said that this is steering, this is slowing, this is everything.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Bruce, it's been awesome.
I got one more I just got to ask. Kind of tied into a few of them. Could be a long-winded, could be a whole different podcast, but the Porsche crowd, they're just so into that brand. Like, what makes a Porsche that good?
Honestly, if you take the brand as a whole and you say this started in 1950, basically, there's no other car, and I'm part of Rennsport, you know, that Porsche event at Monterey. It was somebody at Porsche started it, and then unfortunately he passed away, and then I resurrected it with Porsche in 2011. There's no other brand that year in and year out, decade after decade after decade, 75 years, has built cars that cool, that amazing to drive, and that successful in racing on the other side of it. Nobody. I mean, Mercedes has had their highs in racing, and Ferrari. Porsche's done it year in and year out forever. And it's not magic. Every time you get in their cars, whether you get in a 356 like my little one or you get in a modern one, they do everything right. Everything. They feel right. They look right. They perform unbelievable. And I've always told people, 959 was a real example of this, but I've always told people that generally if you looked at a 356 Porsche compared to everything else in the 50s and 60s, or you looked at it, you took a 70s Porsche, like I have a 72 911, and you take 72 of anything else, that car was at least 10 years ahead of everybody else in everything about it, from how you sit in it, where the steering wheel is, where the gauges are, the pedals, the performance, the stopping, the turning, the handling. That's it. And
that good of a driver's
and once
car.
You've experienced that, and then go back and try to compare it to other things, you're going to come back to it every time. I mean, I don't know of people that I don't even recall meeting a customer that says I don't like a Porsche after they had it. I don't even recall one, ever.
Wow.
So yes. It's just that simple, and it just checks every box, and it does for me. I said, okay, I could buy this very valuable Ferrari, but it doesn't drive near as good as this Porsche, and. So I'd rather have the Porsche. And, oh, yeah, okay, a whole bunch more people have the same car. I don't care. This is the fun car to drive. This is a car. And I tell guys, I have a thing I do. I have a list I make. It's mostly in my head. Sometimes I write it down for people. I write a list of what I call one-hour cars. That's all they're good for, is 1 hour. And I'm not going to say publicly what's on that list.
I got you.
There'll be bullets flying. Right? But Porsche is one of the very few cars that's not a one-hour car. If I drive it for 2 hours or 3 hours or 4 hours without stopping, you have basically little or no fatigue at all. None. And you can drive it as in cruise mode, or you can drive it really, really hard, and you still don't have any fatigue. Okay, so it's proved itself. It's not that a bunch of people decided, now everybody decided. It's one of those things where every time, and over the years, you know, it's funny, I wasn't a Porsche dealer when my dad had the Ford store and our used car lot was full of Porsches once I drove one. And I said, I have probably sold more Porsches to people that never had one and never thought about one than anybody, because they'd say, come with me in this car. And that was it. I'd take them for a ride and they were hooked. And you know, and then over and over and over. So,
yeah, it's interesting. When you really stop and think about the Porsche, like put the Porsche next to like Chevy Camaro and look at the progression. Porsche has stayed true to form almost since its inception to today. I mean, today's 911, I mean, it's like it's recognizable when you put it next to a 70s 911. There's things that cross over between the two, you know, style lines, roof lines, and window, general shape. Look at a Camaro, for example. Like
this, 30 different
shapes. They killed it off three different times. It's changed drastically through every generation that shares nothing with the last one. And then to revive it, they try to make it look like the old one that was great looking, whereas Porsche just stuck with the one that was good looking and just kept evolving.
Porsche started with a very simple, timeless design. And starting with, you know, Ferry Porsche, he was a genius, I mean, with the first car. And then all the way through it, they've always been true to what that car was, because why would you change it? I mean, yeah, they built some water-cooled cars with the 924, 944, 928, but they always ended up back to where this car is what Porsche is, and there's really nothing better than this car in so many ways. And there's a lot of great cars in the world, don't get me wrong. I mean, Mercedes and BMW and Ferrari, and there's all kinds of great cars, but the Porsche is timeless. It's understated, and I'm a guy, design-wise, for me, less is more on everything. I mean, I like less is more. That's why I liked your black Corvette, because that thing is just simple, you know. That car will be cool looking 10 years from now, you know. Right. So,
well, outside on paper, doesn't it, like, everything is wrong?
Yeah.
And how they built the Porsche, motor hanging 3 feet off the back.
Just works. Well, it might just be because we don't know any better.
Well, we know
we're all wrong, and he was right. That's all.
Outside of Porsche, just because I got to ask you this, because you've been behind the wheel so much cool stuff, what crazy, iconic road cars live up to the hype, and what ones don't? And what have you driven that's like, damn, this is cool, and other ones you're like, mm-mm, sucks.
Well, there's a lot of sucks.
Yeah.
But well, you know, over the years, Mercedes has had some incredible cars, and I can't even think of all of them, but when the 500E was built, which was a Mercedes built and collaborated, that car today, when I get one here, it's still an awesome sedan. You know, it's got the power to weight ratio is awesome, the handling, the seats, the way you sit in them, everything about that car is never dated. And so I'm less a BMW fan, but they've had some great cars too. You know, it's kind of hard because everybody's had some great cars over the years. Porsche's had them every year, so it kind of overshadows a lot.
So you get out of a Porsche and you get into a Countach. Is that a spectacular driver's car?
I like Countach. I was a Lamborghini dealer. I sold them new. And I said, this is the coolest tractor in the world. Because that's what it is. The guy built tractors, for Christ's sake. Then he stuck a different body on it, and we had a Countach. So, look, it's raw. It's a beast, but I used to drive them on the back roads out here and slide them through the corners. I said, the chassis's terrible, but it had a tire on it that wide, so you could do that. But I love them. I think they're cool looking. That was the first car you had a poster on your wall. You know, you had the 959 later, but, you know, you started with a picture of a Countach, you know. Right. And if you look at supercars, there's one of the first supercars ever, you know, design-wise, everything. So, you know, as antiquated or as archaic as that thing is, it's just cool, you know. It's just cool. And then, you know, in Ferrari, the F40 is the same way. It's a more modern version of a mechanical kind of beast, you know. I mean, really nothing on it works right, but it's cool looking, and it sounds cool, and it'll spin the tires, and it's fun, you know. And I said, I like those kind of cars. So, you know, it's not one in particular, it's just a bunch of them. So
We're gonna have to edit.
But
that
I like
out.
Trucks. You know, I like pickup trucks and I like all kinds of things. So
we're gonna have to edit that out because we had that debate last night over
what
dinner of what car at the Peterson we would take home, and it was unanimous. Well, not
yeah,
unanimous.
Everybody wanted the F40.
It was 4 out of 5 who would take the F40 home, and Josh was like, "Yeah, probably not that good of a car." I was like, shut up.
And pick the Gullwing.
Well, the Gullwing is, and there's a perfect example. Porsche, if you look at Porsche, they built incredible cars, all kinds of cool-looking cars, Speedster and Roadster and this early 911 and that all the way. And if you go through all of Mercedes' cars and say, it's one car, it's a 300 SL Gullwing. I mean, that thing is the most beautiful car, one of the most beautiful cars in the world. Yeah. And they've never been able to hit that again, quite honestly. Right. They did too good on that car.
Yeah.
But it's just stunning. I mean, every angle.
It could be the most beautiful car of all time. Like yeah. if you put it.
It definitely checks the boxes.
Can we Photoshop his head getting bigger?
No. I think so.
Well, I'm just saying cosmetically.
Yeah, 100%.
So I'm making one into a hot rod.
Are you? We've done some chassis for him. Not actual real ones, but we've had Dave Kindig.
Oh, yeah.
They did a beautiful.
The gray one.
Yeah, it was really cool.
He lives here in the Bay Area.
Yeah.
Yeah, he lives right here.
Yeah, what's his?
Rich Buckley.
Yeah, Rich Buckley.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Yeah, neat car.
Yeah.
But
he's
it's
got
cool.
some cool
he's
stuff. He's got another one going, Roadster.
Electric, right?
Yeah. Does he?
Yeah, the
electric
chassis, too.
Oh, I'm taking points off.
Yeah.
Well, Bruce, it's been awesome. We'd love to see you around the shop. And,
we'll do that.
And there we go.
We will do that for sure.